This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, a new effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally. To find out more, go to tryzonanow.com or call toll-free 1-866-669-9662. Be sure to mention Dr. Hoffman and you'll get a $50 savings and free shipping. That's 1-866-669-9662. Or tryzonanow.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to tell you how you can unlock your personal genetic code to eat for your genes, lose weight, reverse aging. The book is The DNA Restart. And our guest is the author, Dr. Sharon Moalem. He's an MD, PhD, and he's a versatile kind of guy. He's an award-winning physician, scientist, inventor, and a New York Times bestselling author. And he's been awarded more than 25 patents worldwide for his inventions in the field of biotech and human health. So he's kind of a renaissance man, and lately he's turned his attention to the issue of how to optimize our DNA. You know, science now tells us that DNA codes for a lot of our traits, and even may determine whether we're fat or sick, or whether our longevity is going to be limited. But we can enhance the potential of our DNA through some of the measures that Dr. Moalem discusses in his new book. So without further ado, here's our guest, Dr. Moalem. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I think the main theme of your book has to do with something called epigenetics. It's a kind of a buzzword these days, but explain what that means and how that pertains to what you're trying to get across.
So it's really important when we talk about epigenetics to think about that regardless of the genes we inherit, it's really important how they behave. And so epigenetics is that one part of that study looking at genetic behavior and then how that's passed on to the next generation. But regarding the genes that we start our lives out with, everything that we do, everything we eat, exercise affects the way our genes express themselves. And one of the important things that our genes, of course, do is they determine the exact combination of proteins, carbohydrates, and fats that we should be eating. And by figuring out what that combination is, you know, on an individual level, we finally get to move beyond the one-size-fits-all dietary requirements that have been so popular over the last 50 years.
Right, because there's so many nutritional controversies. You know, the people who are the staunch advocates of veganism, and then on the other hand, on the other end of the spectrum, the people who want you on a ketogenic diet that's rich in meat, and then every shade and gradation in between. And it's very perplexing for the public. But what you're arguing for is more of a custom nutrition program that's determined by genetic information?
Precisely. And it's this idea of, you know, moving away from a one-size-fits-all, because a ketogenic diet or a very high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet could work really well for some individuals, but we know that there is no one diet that works well for all. And the classic example I've always discussed with patients and colleagues that everyone is familiar with is lactose intolerance, which of course is encoded by our genes, whether or not we can have dairy as an adult. Are we tolerant or intolerant? And so that also has to do with what were our recent ancestors eating and how were they keeping animals to have their milk? And if you have ancestors that did keep animals for their milk, then likely they've also handed to you the genetic know-how to be able to have dairy as an adult. And if they didn't, then you might not have those genes. And so if there is this one diet that promotes dairy, then you may be out of luck. And so what I've kind of done with DNA Restart is some home genetic self-test that you can do to start kind of optimizing your nutritional intake to your genes. And as I mentioned previously, it really begins with that mix of carbohydrate, protein, and fats. And it really just all starts with a simple cracker test.
Okay, we'll get to that in a minute, but, you know, the buzzword is nutrigenomics, which is, the future science, because we're probably not quite there yet, where you'll be able to simply take a blood test or a saliva test and you get all your genes analyzed. And some companies are out there at the cutting edge, maybe getting a little over the cutting edge, coming back with, tests that purport to tell you, you know, whether you're someone who should be on a predominantly high grain, low fat diet versus the opposite, that they can read your genes and make that determination. So, you choose to take a more simplified approach. Why do you not believe in these, nutrigenomic home tests that people are now performing?
Well, I'm glad that you brought that up, because largely, it's very early at this point. To try to figure out from a genetic perspective, to do genetic testing to kind of figure out what we should be eating. And that's because although they could be, it could be useful to get certain information on a genetic level, you don't really know how your genes are behaving. And so it comes back to how we were saying before, epigenetic or gene expression. Mm-hmm. And so.
So you say you could have a gene, but maybe that gene isn't fully reaching its potential. So an example might be if you have, a lactose intolerance gene, but ultimately, you know, you keep drinking milk and maybe you can extend your ability to drink milk for a while and, you know, vice versa. Some people, have a gene that, they can overcome.
Right. And we've known this actually for a while, and that's from studying identical twins who, from a genetic perspective, have the same DNA that they've inherited and started out their life with, but that DNA is expressing and working in a very different way. And so based upon that model, I came to the conclusion, I said, well, can we do a functional genetic test? Is there a way for us to see, to capture a snapshot of how our genes are behaving? And that led me to develop tests that looked at, for example, the amount of an enzyme in our saliva called amylase, which is tied really tightly to carbohydrate metabolism. And so it turns out that the number of copies of these, of this specific amylase gene that you've inherited from your ancestors determines how much carbohydrates you should be having today.
Okay, and that's interesting because your book helps people circumvent the confusion that might arise with some of these complex genetic tests, plus often the expense. And you actually have some concerns about the potential for confidentiality about these genetic tests. We're feeding a lot of personal information to big databases, and that you've expressed concern about that.
Precisely, because currently there aren't robust laws in place to protect everyone from genetic discrimination. There is, at the federal level, the acronym is called GINA, and that only protects you in situations of health insurance and employment, but doesn't cover you for life insurance and disability. And we know that many of the genes that are involved in nutritional metabolism are actually also predictors of future risk for everything from type 2 diabetes to even specific types of cancer. And so if you go out and spend the money and the energy on getting genetic testing, you might actually be exposing not only yourself, but your family as well to future genetic discrimination unless you're very careful and do that testing anonymously.
So what could possibly go wrong? You're saying that maybe in some futuristic totalitarian situation, or maybe you could be a victim of Julian Assange or Snowden or something, right. You know, like Guccifer, and all of a sudden, and maybe you're running for president, and all of a sudden somebody has snatched a copy of your genetic report and splays it all over the internet. I guess that's not such a far-fetched scenario.
Right. Well, it actually is a lot more benign in the sense that a certain insurance company can request or will be requesting any results from your genetic testing. Or if they ask to see medical records and ask whether or not you've had genetic testing done, then It may be someone's duty to disclose the fact that testing took place and what the results were. And if the results indicate that you're at higher risk for something that might affect insurance, then that's where the potential for discrimination arises.
Or say you're applying for a disability policy or something like that, they might put you at high risk and so on. Well, that's an interesting perspective that we need to keep in mind. But so what are some of these simple home tests that are kind of ingenious?
Well, the one that kind of starts the entire, kicks off the program is a cracker test. And so that's why there's a cracker on the cover of the book. And the reason I employed and used a cracker, because it's a standardized size and we know the amount of carbohydrates in it. Even though there's starches in many other foods, we know that there's 2 grams of starch in an unsalted saltine. And the idea is that, going back to what I was saying about the enzyme amylase that's coded for by our genes. So if our recent ancestors were having a lot of starch-heavy cereal grains in their diet, then they've likely inherited multiple copies of these genes. It's as if they have a genome that's turbocharged and ready for complex carbohydrates. And if that's the case, then the saliva is actually full of this enzyme. And so what I'm actually doing by getting people to do a home test with a simple cracker is it's a way in which of interrogating someone's saliva, finding out what the level of that enzyme is by a simple change in taste. So you put the cracker in your mouth, you start chewing, and it's a timed result, the results of which put you into 3 categories, either a high carbohydrate, a moderate, or a restricted carbohydrate intake.
So you don't have them, like, chew up a cracker, then try to recite the Gettysburg Address, and they would start coughing and sputtering, and the conclusion would be that you're carbohydrate intolerant. That's not how that works. It's based on taste sensations.
Exactly. And when I first started getting people to employ this test, it was actually the results where they were really surprised, because even individuals in the same family who, of course, share many of the same genes were surprised to find out that their, gustatory or taste experience was different. And again, it comes down to genetics. But what that means is that even a family sitting around a dinner table should be having a possibly radically different carb, protein, and fat intake.
Okay. So that's one of the tests. Now, there's also an intriguing test. By the way, for details on that test, get the book. The book is The DNA Restart. I think you lay it out pretty clearly how you can discriminate, what the results might tell you. There's also kind of an ingenious test that speaks to your capability of handling alcohol. We know that there are certain genes that metabolize alcohol, and some people have what's called a hollow leg. They'll drink you under the table. They seem to metabolize alcohol very efficiently. Other people are what might be termed a cheap date, right? They don't metabolize alcohol very well.
Right. And again, this comes back down to where your ancestors relying on their genes to be able to break down alcohol. And so when people first started settling in larger towns and cities, the first thing that usually becomes contaminated is a water supply. And even if they didn't understand why it is that people were getting sick from drinking, because they didn't understand microbes, they knew that through trial and error that if they drank dilute beer and wine all day, they would be protected from getting food poisoning. Mm-hmm. And so those populations develop genetics to be able to metabolize alcohol.
In fact, quite recently, you look at historical accounts, until quite recently, the typical beverage for an American farmer was beer. It was safer.
Right. Yeah, that may be a good way to get people back into farming. That again. And so in different parts of the world where people boiled their water and made tea and drank dilute tea all day, such as East Asia, for example, then there wasn't a large genetic pressure to be able to break down alcohol. And so this has implications even today because certain organizations, like the American Heart Association, recommend, alcohol intake anywhere from 1 to 2 drinks a day for a man and 1 drink per day for a woman.
They kind of encourage you to drink a little bit. You know, yeah. You go to a cardiologist and say, well, have some red wine, you know,
exactly.
Pinot Noir, because it's heart healthy.
Right. And so it comes back to our genes again. You know, did we inherit the genes to follow those guidelines? Because that works really well if you have the genes to metabolize alcohol. And so this genetic home self-test uses the fact that many of the ancestors of people who aren't able to have alcohol actually have a different colored and different textured earwax.
Huh.
And so it's a simple Q-tip test that if you don't already know the color of your earwax or the texture, you use a Q-tip, put it into your ear carefully, and pull it out, and the color in which the wax is usually typically gray or a yellow. Will tell you your alcohol intake. And so if it's gray and flaky, then you're in the lower alcohol. I'm sorry to tell you then, I guess
yeah.
You're in the lower alcohol intake category, which, I've devised to be instead of the 1 to 2 drinks per day, two to three drinks per week. And if you're a female, 1 to 2 drinks per week.
And this is this may be too much information, but I happen to be one of the dry earwax type people, so it would be advisable to cut back. I don't drink hardly anything anymore at all. So this is based on the ability to metabolize alcohol efficiently. Some people break it down better and get rid of the toxic effects more easily.
Right. Right. And so alcohol typically, just to simplify, goes from ethanol to acetaldehyde and then acetic acid. And so it's that middle compound, the acetaldehyde, it builds up in individuals that don't have the genetics to break down alcohol well. And that's actually much more toxic than the alcohol to begin with.
Hmm.
And that's what builds up. And in some individuals, they get what's referred to colloquially as Asian flush.
Yeah.
Because it typically affects a lot of Asians.
Mm-hmm.
And they get red in the face. Dr. Hoffman, does that happen to you?
I don't know. I get a little bit of a nice blush, you know, but not, I think there's an extreme manifestation of that. People who are super intolerant. I probably have maybe, you know, from a genetic standpoint, there's this, you know, homozygous, heterozygous. I think I got a little bit of that trait, but not full on. So that's interesting. So what are some of the other, crucial genes that we know about that, may determine our dietary preferences?
The other important one, and this especially affects people of Western Northern European descent, and it's a gene called HFE on chromosome 6, and this is a crucial gene that's involved in iron metabolism and absorption from the diet. And it particularly affects males and females once they're done menstruating, and the reason is that males are not losing iron on a daily basis, and so all the iron that they're absorbing from their diet gets compounded, because what this gene does is it turns people into a giant magnet, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very good at, you know, stripping whatever iron that's coming in, and they're absorbing it. And you know, where most people are familiar with what happens when you become anemic and you don't have enough iron, yet having too much iron is actually much more concerning, because it really puts you at risk for everything from diabetes to heart disease.
It's kind of like a cellular rust. You start to, iron being a heavy metal, a prooxidant, that it starts to literally start a rust-like process in all your organs.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's also one of the thoughts that we're thinking that, increased consumption of red meat in particular may be promoting certain types of colorectal cancer. The thinking is that it's that increased exposure to the rusting effect of iron. So you can imagine, if you have genetics that are fine tuned to increase the amount of iron, and if you're having red meat or iron rich foods and vegetables, you're then at risk from, you know, rusting to death, essentially, from the inside out.
Mm-hmm. Are there such things as fat genes, genes that predispose to obesity, or conversely, genes that keep people thin in spite of putting on the feed bag?
Yeah, there have been a lot of association studies, but what's interesting is that it's, of course, a combination of there's a gene-diet interaction. And coming back again to the amylase gene that I mentioned earlier, that we were testing for with the saliva, what's been found is that people on a Western, say, carb-heavy, starch-heavy diet, so 50% of our intake being from complex carbohydrates, the people who don't have enough amylase genes are actually at risk for obesity, type 2 diabetes, and metabolic syndrome, as opposed to people who have multiple copies of those genes, and they do just fine with a low BMI. And so many of the studies now, that the genes that we're kind of understanding how they're involved, are sometimes challenging to find those interactions, because they don't work on their own. It depends upon how we're living our own lives.
Right. It's really a complex dance, because I've done some genetic analysis on myself. And, you know, when I look at all the genes that are involved, there may be 20 or 30 or 40 genes that in some way or another determine risk for obesity. You know, it's kind of like, okay, you got 5 bad ones and 15 good ones and some equivocal ones. And, oh, by the way, are you following a healthy lifestyle? And that, of course, can modify the expression of those genes. So it's a little hard to read tea leaves from some of those tests.
Right. It is. And that's why I'm not a big proponent of doing a lot of genetic or genomic testing for that reason, because we also don't know how all those genes, and that's what you're alluding to, how do they all behave together? You know, what does that dance look like? And even when it comes to the HFE, the iron overload gene that I mentioned earlier, we know that there's other genes that moderate that gene in the way it behaves. And so none of our genes are really behaving on their own. And of course, not just with the environment, but with each other.
Well, we know that you can get tests for iron. You can get tests even more precisely for ferritin. And you can actually, and I have done this in some people where we want to confirm a diagnosis of this condition, hemochromatosis, you can actually get the HFE test now. It's a specific
Yes.
test one gene. So how do people get a handle on that particular thing? Should they ask their doctor for a specific test to find out their iron status?
Yeah, and so I think most people who are getting a physical done are actually getting some of the testing done that you mentioned, but it's to possibly add a transferrin saturation and a ferritin test to their blood work, and that'll give them a good snapshot of where they're at.
Okay, so good. This, you've set the stage for a discussion of some of the issues that you tackle in the DNA restart. We're all different. We require different dietary approaches. These are some of the ways that you can determine whether or not you're suited for one dietary approach or another. There's a lot more to the DNA restart, and then listeners know that we divide these podcasts into two parts. So when we return, we're going to take a look at some of the other important suggestions in the DNA restart. We're talking to Dr. Sharon Moalem, and we'll be right back with more of Intelligent Medicine. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.